You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hidden, a true crime podcast. A forensic psychologist and a journalist explore the hidden motives behind unthinkable crimes while examining our deepest fears along the way.
We had an incredible week. A lot of people discovering our podcast, a lot of people sharing our podcast and YouTube video. And YouTube does an interesting thing. They let you see all sorts of data and information. I don't even know how they gather all of it, but they let you know how people find your channel. And I don't know necessarily how, maybe it's when they share a link, when someone shares a link or someone clicks on a link that was sent to them, it'll tell you that it was a referral or someone recommended the channel. And last week, like I said, we had the most incredible week of growth, and it was from people sharing our podcast and sharing our YouTube channel, and we want to thank you. For those new to our channel, we are a husband and wife team. So I am a journalist. I was a TV reporter for 10 years, and Dr. Babe, my babe, is a forensic psychologist. There you go. There's a smile. I was watching people say, why doesn't he smile? Because he's such a serious psychologist.
Because I'm in such a serious profession.
Tonight, we have an exciting show planned for you. We're going to answer a lot of your questions, and we'd love for you to subscribe. All right, John, the show is yours. No pressure.
Since we're talking about how serious I am, maybe we should start on a little bit of a light note with the correspondence we received from Karen Rose and her wonderful dog, Cookie.
We want to give Cookie a shout out. Cookie is watching tonight. Cookie, let's make this bigger, is a fan of ours, watches us each week. And her friend Karen let us know that Cookie was a little disappointed that we did not thank Bubba and Cash in our last episode, as we thanked so many that have researched this case. And Cookie wanted us to thank Bubba and Cash, and rightfully so. It is true that it's because of Bubba and Cash that Paul not only filmed those last minutes of his life, Alec spoke on them, speaking to Bubba. And we know how much both Paul and Maggie love those dogs. So Cookie, thank you for reminding us to thank those important animals in our life who truly did solve this case.
And I should mention too that Bubba and Cash were instrumental in helping the jury understand that the so-called vigilante intruder was probably someone in the family, because Bubba and Cash did not bark or did not, right? They didn't create any type of disturbance or commotion. And so that seemed to indicate that whoever murdered Paul and Maggie was someone that the dogs knew. So that was another little bit of credit that goes to the dogs.
Cookie is a forensic psychologist.
That's great. Yes, indeed. Thank you for that great
insight. Maybe we'll have Cookie live with us one day. We love Cookie. Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Thank you, Karen, for sending that in to us.
Let's start with one of the questions we received during the week.
This is a question from Anne Burling. Anne, thank you for this question. She asks, could Paul have gotten away from this family?
Yeah, this is, it's such a simple question, but it has so many implications. I really love this question. It's a great question. It's going to really force us to dig a little deeper into family systems. We've talked a lot about family systems, and we've talked about the multi-generational transmission of trauma in families and shame and how that impacts families over time. But I really haven't talked about more specifically about what a family system is and how a family system operates. So this question, I think, is going to send us down that path a little bit. I want to introduce a couple of terms, or I want to introduce one term that's going to really stay with us tonight for our discussion, and that term is homeostasis. Homeostasis essentially means balance, or maybe a better term would be equilibrium. So in every family, there's tremendous tendency or need to achieve homeostasis. The way that happens is that families have different feedback loops. So when information or in family systems work, it's sometimes called when deviations are introduced into a system, the system has to respond to those deviations. The system has to process that information in some way that they can maintain homeostasis or balance. This question about Paul is really a question about how this family maintains homeostasis and what they do when information or deviations enter the system. In other words, how they process information. So that's what I kind of want to talk about in answering this question. And I think it'll actually help us understand the Murdoch family a little better as well. I want to start with, since we're talking about the low country, I want to start with something that's roughly referred to as the crab bucket effect. I'm sure some of you guys have probably heard of this, but the crab bucket effect is basically what occurs when you take a group of crabs. Let's say that these crabs are a family. You take a group of crabs in a bucket with water, and let's say that the bucket isn't that high. Let's say it's a reasonably tall bucket or medium-sized bucket. Invariably, what happens is some or many of the crabs attempt to climb out of the bucket. But when they do that, one or several of the crabs will grab them and pull them back in the bucket. So you have this family of crabs, and the crabs try to get out and they get pulled back in. That's called the crab bucket effect. And the reason I mention that is because that's about equilibrium. That's about homeostasis. That the crabs don't want other crabs to leave the bucket because they want the equilibrium of having all the crabs in the bucket. So I think there's some analogies there with families. When I think of the crab bucket effect, I actually think of a quote from Tolstoy. This is the first sentence from Anna Karenina, which is one of Tolstoy's great novels. He says, this is a quote from Tolstoy, first sentence, famous sentence, very famous sentence. Tolstoy says, quote, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." For those who know Tolstoy, you probably know that Tolstoy was a deeply unhappy human being. It's not clear why that was the case. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about why, but he was a very wealthy person. He achieved a level of fame that most people never would. He had a wonderful family, had a wife that loved him, and yet he was still really unhappy. So this quote, actually, to me, I think it's somewhat sarcastic. I think what Tolstoy is saying is happy families are rare if they exist at all, but every unhappy family, that most families are unhappy, and they're sort of unhappy in their own way. And the reason why this quote is relevant and why the crab bucket effect is relevant to our discussion is because I think it indicates that in many ways we're all kind of stuck with our families. And no matter how much we try to escape our families, we're still stuck in that bucket with the crabs. So this speaks to this idea of equilibrium and, you know, maybe this idea of unhappiness. I mean, yes, there are some families that are happy and exceptionally healthy, but they're not a high percentage of those families. You know, I want to introduce this idea of equilibrium, and it'll become important as we continue tonight.
So that'll be our theme, equilibrium.
I think what happens in the Murdoch family is that things really start changing with the boat crash. Well, actually, let me back up a little bit and explain what makes the Murdoch family so unusual is the fact that the family system and the judicial system are in some ways connected. And the reason that's true is because the solicitor position, which was created in 1920, in many ways for Randolph the First. That's when he becomes a solicitor, which is essentially the position of being a DA. In the Murdoch family, this is a unique situation because the judicial system is controlled by the family. They have a law firm, which is controlled by the family, and then you have the family system. So in some ways, the law firm connects the judicial system to the family system. There's so much overlap there in terms of how things are understood, how information gets processed, right? So that, for example, let's go back to 1956 when Buster the First was accused of bootlegging. Because he was the solicitor, he had the capacity to suppress a lot of that information in the judicial system, right? And because he was working in the law firm, he was able to figure out who some of the witnesses were going to be that were going to testify against him. And so you had this overlap between the information that was in the judicial system, the information that was available to the law firm, and the information that was in the family system. It's very unusual that you'll see this kind of overlap. You know, like, for example, in our family, you know, I might have some ties to the judicial system in terms of doing forensic evaluations and knowing some judges, but I have really no control over how that information gets interpreted and controlled. But that's not true in the Murdoch family, because the solicitor position essentially allows the family to control all the information. When Randy or John Marvin or a lot of these folks in the family say, hey, we're just regular people, this is just a normal family, they're kind of neglecting to tell you that that's not true, because this is a family that has a great deal of overlap between their private issues in the family system and the public issues in the judicial system, which are both in some ways connected by the law firm. So you've got all this overlap, you've got all this power because of this overlap, you've got all these conflicts of interest, right? So this brings us to our story about the boat crash and how that's so important in this family. So you have this boat crash involving Paul, and in terms of talking about homeostasis, you have an anomaly or a deviation introduced into the system, which is that Paul committed a crime, right? This is very unwelcome information. This is information the system does not want to know. And so what's the first thing that the family system does with this information? They try to suppress it, right? They go, Handsome and Alec, they show up at the hospital. They're trying to see Connor Cook. They're trying to convince Connor that he was the one driving the boat. You know, they're trying to say to him, hey, look, don't worry about this. You know, we got your back. Just say that you were driving the boat. It's no big deal. The police will come in and they'll take your statement. When you have this deviation or this introduction of unwelcome and unwanted information in the system, the first thing that the system tries to do is to get back to equilibrium. So the way they're doing that is they're suppressing that information. They're trying to deny that it's happening. They're trying to put this on Connor Cook. Right away, the family system of the Murdochs the Murdoch system is trying to achieve some sort of equilibrium by denying or neglecting the importance of that information, that deviation that's already entered the system, right? You know, it's interesting because in the first documentary called Deadly Dynasty, there was a guy that in there that's his identity wasn't revealed. And do you remember that? He was sort of blacked out.
Yes.
He made a comment. So he was blacked out because he was friends of the family and he knew the family very well. And he said something to the effect of, if Buster One was alive, Connor Cook would have either confessed to driving the boat or he would be crab meat. So let's go back to this idea of equilibrium. You have this unwanted information that enters the system, and this is how the system deals with it. They try to suppress it. They try to cover it up, right? They're trying to get rid of that information so the system can go back to the way it was. And the way it was, you know, a family of power and prestige and privilege. And so they don't want any change. This is about change too. Equilibrium is about maintaining the status quo, and it's about keeping things the way they are. The problem here with the Murdoch family is Alec is no longer the solicitor. He's a volunteer solicitor. And this is a family with less power. This is a family now that doesn't control the information coming in and out of the judicial system as much as they used to. They still have power. They still know people in places of power. They still know politicians, but they're not as powerful as they were. And so what's going on is the judicial system is now focused more on facts, and they're more willing to acknowledge these deviations in the system than they were previously. The judicial system is now kind of taking precedence over the family system's ability to control it. You have all this information about the boat crash. You have, thankfully, you have Mallory Beach's attorney, Mark Tinsley, who's persistent and pursuing this law. You know, he's pursuing this issue doggedly. He's not going to let the family just whitewash this information or suppress it. So his persistence keeps this thing alive too. You're seeing a clash here between the Murdoch family system trying to really suppress this information and the judicial system moving forward with facts rather than distortions. And what's occurring during this process is because the family system is no longer able to control that information in the judicial system, you're seeing a lot of stress build up. That this is becoming a really stressful situation for the Murdochs. In addition to that, you have Alec and his financial crimes are starting to come out. You have Paul continuing to act out. He's still drinking like crazy. He's not really stopping his behavior to any major extent. You're getting these deviations in the system that the family system can't handle. And in family systems, this is sometimes called a runaway feedback loop, meaning that when the deviations become so large that the system is now out of control, there's no way to get equilibrium back. So this idea of homeostasis is so important here because the Murdoch family for generations has really tried to keep things the same. They've tried to maintain the status quo. And now with the boat crash, you're getting all of this unwanted information in the system, all these deviations. The information is just spiraling out of control. It's like I said, it's called a runaway feedback loop. People also call it an amplifying deviation, but think of it as a runaway train, right? That when the engine on the train fails and the deviations in making that engine work properly are too severe, the train is now careening over the end of the, like something has to stop that train.
The train hasn't just left the station. It's going.
Right. You have a family system that's essentially unable to contain this information in a way that suits them. And so you have this runaway feedback loop and something's got to give. You know, if we go back to the crab bucket effect metaphor or analogy, the way I would perceive this is that Paul doesn't really want to climb out of this bucket, by the way. The better way to see this is think of it as that Paul's injured and somehow that injury is now becoming toxic for the other crabs in the bucket. The system has to deal with this some way. You've got to either take the crab to the doctors. You've got to get the crab out of the bucket. I think in the Murdoch family system, you know, the way to see this is something severe has to happen to stop this runaway feedback loop. It's either going to be prison, it's going to be death, which we know was the end result. Or maybe there's another solution like sending them to South America. I don't know. You know, to me, the better option here would have been just to face the consequences.
Yeah.
Paul is a first-time offender. You know, my guess is they could have gotten him a plea deal that was very favorable. You know, I think the Murdochs simply did not want to have Paul spend any time in prison. What's remarkable about this is that the Murdoch family was able to take these deviations in the system and suppress them for over 2 years. There were literally no hearings. You know, I'm sure they tried endless times to get this thrown out. It's quite easy to imagine that if Buster One was in power, that none of this, no charges would have been brought, right? The whole thing would have been completely thrown out. Paul would have walked scot-free. And that was Paul's expectation, by the way. So I think the family understood this point very well, that when there were anomalies or deviations in the system, that it was very easy for this family to squash that information and to get back to equilibrium, to maintain the status quo. So this is about, in some ways, change. Having a system that's on the cusp of change or has to change and adapt to really survive. And because they want to maintain the family legacy, they don't adapt. In fact, even now, Jim Griffin made a statement after the trial essentially saying they're even more convinced of Alex's innocence and they're steadfastly behind him, right? That's a crazy thing to say after this trial.
It is.
This is a family that will not adapt. They will not acknowledge that with the boat crash and with their lessening of power, that in some ways things have changed. This is a family that's clinging to power at all costs. They're clinging to this delusion. These murders didn't take place. This is their way of trying to maintain homeostasis. And that's kind of the idea behind family systems.
Randy, though, let's clarify that, because, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, Randy doesn't support the family anymore. Not Randy. But I want to say I read that New York Times article that interviewed Randy, and he never said that he knows his brother is guilty. I mean, there's a big difference. I mean, he might not be standing steadfast with him saying he's completely innocent and he's faultless, but I think it's also smooth, right? He's got to worry about his own reputation, and his brother does lie, and he admitted that on the stand, and he admitted of his drug addiction. So he's pretty much just repeating what Alec has already said about himself, saying, yes, he's a serial liar and he's a drug addict, and I don't know what he knows. But I guess I just want to throw that out there too, because I keep hearing that Randy's turned on his brother, and I don't know if that's...
We're going to talk about that in a second, actually.
Okay, good.
I want to stay with this idea of Paul getting out of the system, because this is such a critical idea for family systems. My short answer to this question is it would have been really, really hard for Paul to leave this family system. And that brings me to another idea that I think is really important here. And that is, there's a family systems theorist. His name is Murray Bowen. And he has this term called emotional cutoff. Emotional cutoff is basically when we try to distance ourselves from our families, either emotionally or physically. And let's go back to the crab bucket analogy. since we're talking about low country, I think that's a good one I want to stay with. But so imagine that one of the crabs escapes from the bucket in South Carolina, and somehow the crab is able to wiggle its way into the ocean, and let's say it goes to France. Let's say it goes to a foreign country very far away.
Okay, France.
And it crawls up on the beach in Normandy from South Carolina, and the crab thinks, I finally did it. I got away from my family. I'm in a foreign country. I don't have to talk to them. I don't have to deal with them. I'm finally free of all my family dysfunction, right? So that's called emotional cutoff. Now, that seems like a good idea, except there's one major problem with that attempt to escape from the family. And that is that even though that crab is on the beach in Normandy, the crab feels like they're still in the bucket. That emotionally, that crab cannot get out of that bucket, because no matter what, no matter how far away it goes, no matter whether or not that crab talks to the family of other crabs in the bucket, the crab feels like it's still in the bucket. And that's the issue. And so Murray Bowen had this idea of what he called differentiation of self. And Murray Bowen's idea was, that crab can swim to France and get away, but it's still stuck in the emotional system of the family dynamics. And it will never get away from that unless that crab spends a lot of time thinking about its life, dealing with its emotions, reflecting on the family, and trying to distance itself in a healthy way, in a healthy, reflective way from its family of origin. And a big part of Bowen's approach was he would work with people on differentiation, on separating themselves from their families in some ways, mainly emotionally. But he would assign homework where he would have people go back to their families and kind of test out whether they were caught up in the dysfunction or caught up in the arguments or all the family, you know, shenanigans. And so that was how Bowen perceived it, that yes, that crab can escape the bucket, but usually the crab still feels like it's in the bucket. And it takes a lot of work to differentiate yourself from the other crabs in that bucket. And so this issue, getting back to the question, could Paul have gotten away? There's many ways in which I think in some ways this was sort of a, I don't want to say predetermined, but it was in many ways, I think it was kind of a fatalistic outcome after the boat crash, because Paul, as we talked about, Paul was very much scapegoated. Paul was perceived as sort of the weak crab in the bucket, right? That I think it would have been really, really difficult to get away for Paul. And not only that, I think more importantly, I think Paul didn't want to get out of the bucket. I think Paul would have had to really have some strong desire to get away from his family and to sort all this out. And as far as I can tell, he actually liked being associated with this family and their power, and he would flaunt that. So Paul really had no interest in removing himself from that bucket, as dysfunctional as it was.
Well, let me ask you this then. Let's take a different scenario. You sort of mentioned, not sort of, you mentioned earlier that what he should have done is face the consequences. He was a first-time offender. You wish he had gotten help. What would that have been like? Let's say they accepted this fate. He was convicted, sentenced for, you know, manslaughter, and he was able to get help. What then? What would that help?
To me, that would have been the best path here. You know, the problem with that path is that the risk is that there was some talk that the charges taken together could land Paul in prison for up to 25 years. So the consequences were very severe. Now, that could be negotiated, I assume. This is the Murdoch family. They can negotiate anything. So there were a lot of reasons why they didn't want to take that path. One was the shame, right? That if Paul was driving that boat and had something to do with the death of Mallory Beach, then that's deeply embarrassing to this family. They just don't want to deal with that. This family just lacks the capacity to process emotion or to deal with difficult emotions. So a lot of things would have had to happen for them to go down that path. They would have had to, one, work as closely as a family. They would have had to be able to process the magnitude. I called it a deviation, but they would have had to really process the magnitude of that deviation or what that meant in the system. And what that would mean in the system is that the family would have to change. The family would have to be healthier. The family would have to really deal with the trauma of that incident. They'd have to deal with the reality of it, that it's a crime. They'd have to deal with the shame associated with it, that it's deeply embarrassing to them as a family, right? They'd have to deal with all these issues that they've tried to cover up for generations.
A permanent blemish on their legacy.
That's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know that Shopify lets you sell in person too? Yep, Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere, online, in line, and on social media. With Shopify, you get a selling partner like never before. Shopify personally helps us connect to our gems in line and online, and helps us drive store traffic with tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram. Get personalized hardware to fit your business and know that Shopify is there to lend support every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/hiddentruecrime, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/hiddentruecrime to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/hiddentruecrime. A quick word from our sponsor. Mother's Day is just around the corner, and I want to tell you about a very special book. It's called MyLifeInABook.com. It's a service that also turns your mom's life stories into a book. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question via email, and then your mom types her responses or record her voice, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, her adventures, her strength, and perseverance after losing John's mom just a few months ago. Sharing her stories helps us keep her memory alive. And so we've gifted mylifeinabook.com to family members. My dad is legally blind, and typing can be tedious when you can't see, but my dad can actually record his answers with voice, and mylifeinabook.com transcribes his audio. It's been an enjoyable thing for my dad to tell his stories, and his book is almost done. I don't think there is any gift that matters more than preserving our stories. Stories change us and teach us about what we value most. This service now puts our stories into the most beautiful, high-quality book. Check out mylifeinabook.com and use code HIDDENTRUECRIME at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code HIDDENTRUECRIME for 10% off today.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
I think for us, hopefully, I don't want to say normal, but for reasonably normal people that are facing something like this, I think hopefully, you know, you look at the options and the consequences and you kind of weigh them and you deal with the emotional repercussions and hopefully you make a good decision. And even if that involves, you know, if you even have to spend 2 or 3 years in prison, that's a better option than just denying the whole thing and pretending it didn't happen. So I think a lot of things would have had to change within this entire family system for them to really confront this in a rational, productive manner. This question about whether Paul could have escaped or gotten away from this family system, I think it's a great question because it really gets to the heart of the meaning of family systems and this idea of equilibrium and how important it is for families to maintain that, even if it means losing everything. We talked about this in our last book club meeting, but one of the true stories in the book was that a woman was in one of the towers at the World Trade Center and she witnessed the plane hit the first plane hit.
The book you're referring to really quickly is
The Examined Life by Stephen Gross, G-R-O-S-Z.
Yeah, this was last month's book.
Yeah, last month's book. The woman, her name, she's a real woman. He talked about in the book. Her name is Marissa Panagrosso, and she was in one of the towers. The plane hits. She drops everything, heads for the exits. Her life is saved. But all her coworkers are trying to process the information, and they can't make sense of it, and they stay. They don't head for the exits. One of them says, I have to get my stuff. I've got to get, you know, the pictures of my family. They all hesitate, and as a consequence, tragically, her coworkers all died when the second plane hit that, you know, the second tower. And the point that he was trying to make is that even when something is so obvious as a plane hitting the World Trade Center tower, it's really hard for us to change. It's really hard for us to process that information. And even if it means that we lose everything, that the idea of change for so many of us is so difficult. And I think for a family that's had power for so many generations, like the Murdochs, this idea of maintaining equilibrium and power and resisting change is just so compelling. That this is a family that if they're in the World Trade Center tower and the first plane hits, they probably don't leave. So, you know, it's a really interesting dynamic that in family systems, this idea of homeostasis explains a great deal about why change is so difficult.
Truth teller says, you don't know different unless you see different. So would that be the same scenario with Paul if he got help? Would he be able to get away? I don't know.
You know, he did actually go into therapy for a little bit, but it didn't affect any change at all. And I think for Paul to really get out of this family system, the family would probably have to work together as a unit. If we go back to our crab bucket analogy, the family would have to actually support him leaving the bucket.
And that's the hardest part.
The hardest part is that most families don't have the resilience and the emotional intelligence to really support their members and lift them up to leave the bucket. Most families are more like the crabs that pull the members back in, right? Because it's hard. It's hard. If one member changes in a family, oftentimes other members are forced to confront their own issues and they're forced to change to some degree also.
I have a great question here from a Caroline. Caroline Williams asks, now that Alex has been convicted, how will the family, and especially Buster, deal with this shame? And several other people in chat were also asking a similar question. How will the family, especially Buster, deal with the pain?
There's some overlap between that question and the last one about Paul, but I think the short answer is not well. We started talking about Randy in his New York Times interview. Randy, he sort of approaches talking about the fact that his brother may have done it, but he never gets there.
Right.
So in that sense, he's still avoiding that issue.
It reminded me of the way Alec avoided the question from Creighton Waters that we discussed, was it last week? Tell me a time you looked at someone in their eyes and lied to them. And he would say, I can't tell you a time. I can say that I stole a lot of money. I admit that. I did that. And I know that I lied to people. Well, tell me about one time. He couldn't go there. It's the same thing. They can't. It seems like they have this limit.
I think this is a family that really hasn't dealt with or faced any painful emotions over the generations. I mean, not directly, maybe indirectly, but, and I think that really leads to this, the term we sometimes use in psychology, it's called alexithymia, which is the inability to really process or understand emotions. And I think this is a family that maybe on a family level, this is a family that really doesn't want to deal with difficult emotions. And that gets passed down through the generations, by the way, because when you avoid dealing with difficult emotions, let's say it's sadness, when anytime someone in your family is sad and you just ignore that, or you overlook it, or even worse, you say, let's say a child's becoming sad and you say to the child, we don't get sad in this family, right? You're telling the child you can't be sad and it's not okay. It's not what we do in this family. Or if a child says, I'm feeling embarrassed, right? That's a form of shame. If you say to a child, we don't acknowledge embarrassment in this family, you need to be strong, right? I could see something like that in the Murdoch family. When you do that over generations and the families learn not to process difficult emotions, this is where you land. So Randy, in his interview, it feels like he wants to say it. It feels like there's a part of him that's tempted to say, yeah, I think my brother did it. But he can't. He simply can't, because I think it would be too painful for him. We talked about this idea of equilibrium. It would upset the family equilibrium. This is a family that's expected to stay together. They're a mesh. They're expected to maintain the same family myth. The family myth is that they're powerful and they're perfect and they're above the law. It would really require him to kind of step outside of the bucket, to acknowledge that his brother committed murder when every other one of the members of the family is, to quote Jim Griffin, they're steadfast in his innocence. I think that would be a deviation in this family system. And he doesn't do it. So he steps up to the edge, but he doesn't cross that line. He doesn't acknowledge that his brother's a murderer. I think you're right. I think there's a political component to that in the sense that he has a law firm and there might be clients that are upset if he sticks with the family and says, you know, my brother's innocent, then he might lose some business. So yeah, you know, there's a political component, but I think more importantly, there's an emotional component that he won't allow himself to deviate from the family myth, and he won't allow himself to really deal with all the painful emotions that might go along with admitting that your brother's a murderer.
I'm seeing a lot of stories from survivors in chat, and I want to thank everyone for being brave enough to share. And also, we're always in awe that people feel like this is a safe space for survivors. And so thank you. Paul, I hope it's okay that I read this out loud, Paula Marie, but she says, my father walked up to me and almost slapped me across the face while he said, we don't have feelings and we most certainly will never talk about them.
Thanks for sharing that, Paula. That's exactly what I'm talking about. If you want to potentially create generations where they're not dealing with shame and they're not dealing with sadness and they're not dealing with feelings, that's exactly how you would do it. I hope Paula Marie was able to challenge that and overcome that. And for that, I give her a lot of credit. The question here is, now that Alec has been convicted, how will the family and especially Buster deal with shame? So I think the same would apply to Buster here. If we're talking about Buster, I think the plagiarism issue has to be deeply shameful for him. And yet, he, as far as I can tell, he's never, at least not in the jailhouse conversations, he's never talked about that with his father, and he's never gone back to law school. So I think the evidence seems to indicate that Buster's struggling, that Buster's not going to deal with his shame from that, that Buster thinks that, you know, we know from his taking the stand, he thinks that Paul was not driving the boat. There's certainly a huge level of denial in that and probably an avoidance of shame there. He seems to believe his father's innocent. Again, that would be a complete negation of any type of emotion or shame or pain around the fact that his father probably or did murder his brother and his mother. I mean, all of that would certainly suggest that this family is really struggling to process what happened at a meaningful level, and they're just not going to budge from this level of equilibrium that they're so used to, which is, you know, that this is a family with a lot of power, maybe family that used to have a lot of power, but they're going to struggle. They're going to really struggle to process this information and to deal with it in a healthy manner. And from all we can tell, it seems like they're not.
Kathy stated, unfortunately, I know too many people who escaped the family bucket, but unfortunately climbed into another bucket that was unhealthy. The crab can't adapt to any other surroundings other than this bucket. And even if you do escape, you might find yourself in another or a situation that's familiar to you.
That's the idea of the crab swimming to France. The crab can go as far away from the family as you can imagine, and yet it's still not healthy because the crab is still connected to the bucket. It still feels like it's in the bucket. And so, yeah, that would be a very common scenario for the crab that has not processed those emotions or differentiated from the family. The crab more than likely will crawl in a similar dysfunctional bucket. So I like that analogy that, you know, you keep going from one unhealthy bucket to the next unless you've learned to differentiate yourself and to really deal with some painful emotions and maybe some shame too.
Taylor asks, what advice would you give to help a family that may be experiencing this sort of dysfunction so they can make better choices for themselves and future generations? It's a great question. Thank you, Taylor.
The first step would have to be some recognition of the dysfunction. It would have to be some recognition or identification or awareness of the problem. If you don't recognize the problem, then you certainly can't deal with it. That's part of the issue with the Murnochs too. You know, when you hear John Marvin or Randy saying, and they both said a version of this, John Marvin said it on the stand, but when they say, oh, we're just so normal, we're just like everyone else in this community, There's a lot of denial in that. There's a lot of distortion in that. You're not going to possibly deal with the problem if you don't acknowledge it or recognize it, right? So in some ways, by the Murnochs trying to claim that we're so normal, you know, we're just like you, they're really avoiding that there is dysfunction. They're really avoiding that this is an issue to begin with. And, I think that's part of the tragedy here is, and again, this gets back to the idea of homeostasis, right? That they want to maintain their image at all costs, and they're willing to do anything to kind of avoid any unwelcome information from entering their system. That, you know, they're making statements like that. We're just normal like you. Well, you're not. You controlled the judicial system in this county, in Hampton County, for nearly 100 years. You know, so by saying that, I think they're really negating that there's a problem. So I think the first step, to answer this question by Taylor, the first step is there has to be some awareness of the problem. Otherwise, there's nothing you can do. So actually, I'm thinking of what we call the stages of change. James Prochaska was the first person to kind of articulate these. But there's the first stage is called the pre-contemplation stage. And that's a state. These are the stages of change. The pre-contemplation means you're not even thinking about change. It's not even on your mental map. It's not even imaginable. And so I think the Murdochs would seem to be in that stage of change. There's not even a thought of change. By the way, that's incredible to me. If that's accurate, it's incredible to me because this is a family that's had to deal with so many stressors and so many challenges to the family system, so many deviations, so many anomalies. systems change when they come under stress. This is a family that's come under so much stress. And yet they're saying things like, oh, we're just as normal as you. It seems to me like they're in the pre-contemplation stage of change, which means they're probably not really considering it. There's a scale. It's called the Holmes and Ray stress scale. It was developed many years ago, like 1967. It's kind of a famous scale. They did some research on what they perceived to be the most stressful life events you could ever experience. Mm-hmm. Their number one stressor, which is scored at 100 points, is the death of a spouse. Child deaths were not researched that well in terms of the stress that they created, but they don't even include that as a stressor. If the death of a spouse is 100, the death of a child is probably even more. But they don't even have that on their scale because it, I don't know why. Think of it like this. You've got the death of a spouse is the most stressful thing you could ever experience. The death of a child, which isn't on their scale, it's an oversight, I think, but that would be even worse, right? And then you have, in order, you have a divorce, separation, all those are stressful, prison term, death of a close family member, personal injury or illness, a marriage. So that could be a positive thing, but it's stressful. And then number eight is you're fired from work, you have financial problems. So if you think about the stress scale and the Murdochs, they have almost every one of those. Like, this is a family that's experienced so much stress, it's even unimaginable, right? And yet,
right.
And yet they're not changing, they're not budging an inch. It's amazing.
You know, you said two things. You state they're not like us because they have this privilege and this power that very few families have. But at the same time, you're saying they're not like us because they've experienced so much stress. And, you know, there's two extremes here, I feel like. The privilege, so much stress, not showing emotions, unhealthy. Do they go together?
I think that's a different idea. I think that when they're saying we're so normal, just like you, I think they're minimizing or avoiding the fact that they're not. In other words, they're avoiding the fact that maybe they should develop some awareness of their dysfunctions and their problems, and they're not willing to do that. The stress part is the reason I bring that in is because I think it shows how the Murdoch family system is so inflexible. Any family system, I think, subjected to the kind of stress that the Murdochs have been subjected to would probably at least force them to think about who they are, right? And think about their family system. And for most families, this kind of stress would force a readjustment. Let's put it that way. It would force them to kind of rethink their system and who they are, or at least to get help. I don't know. But like, this system isn't budging. You can just throw stressor after stressor at them. But I mean, of course, the end result of this type of dysfunction was murder. So clearly dealing with stressors was not, coping with stress was not a big part of this family system. Or it was not something they did very well.
I just have to bring this up because this is something John and I have talked a lot about in private. So a Venus gal says, I keep forgetting there's a sister. And I've mentioned this to John a lot. Well, actually, yeah. No, John's brought this up. And since he's brought it up, I've noticed, but he has stated, if you want to know how patriarchal this family is, how many times do you hear about Lynn?
Right. Never. Although she attended court every single day of the trial. She's really supportive of Alec. She, you know, toes the party line about how he's innocent and how Paul was not driving the boat. And so, you know, you'd have to think that she's perpetuating this family myth too. Since we're moving over into the arena of change a little bit, I just want to mention that I've talked about this before on other shows and podcasts, but the idea of a mental map, I think, is really important to me in terms of explaining some of this, which is that psychologists use different terms for this. I like the term mental map because I think it's a little more descriptive, but sometimes psychologists will say scripts or schemas or cognitive networks. Unfortunately, we're not really unified on what to call this, but we all develop these mental maps of the world, and those maps include beliefs, emotions, kind of everything we use to interpret the world. It's interesting to me that stress is one of the major components of forcing us to kind of shift our mental maps a little bit, the force change, whether we like it or not. It's oftentimes a reflection of mental health in terms of the degree to which we can change or adapt our mental maps. You know, changing our mental maps is called resilience. When we lose a spouse, for example, so I said that's the number one stressor. When we lose a spouse or a child that have been a part of our lives for a long time, somehow we have to adapt or change those mental maps to reflect the fact that that spouse is no longer there. That doesn't mean that we won't still value them and they won't be a part of the map. It's just that we may not come home every day to our spouse and get a lot of support or a hug, or right, that you have to change that map to some degree. And it's sometimes useful to think of families as having that kind of map as well. And in some ways, in a mesh family, they all kind of have the same mental map. The Murdochs, for example, they probably all have very mm-hmm. similar mental maps. And again, like, the thing that's incredible to me about this family is that I don't think those maps have really changed. In spite of all the losses and all the stressors, they just keep going back to that same narrative. They keep going back to the same beliefs. There's really no attempt to deal with emotions. At some level, in order for this family to really change, or for any of us to change, and this gets back to the question about how can a family change, you have to really explore whatever that mental map is you have of the world. And it takes time, by the way. It's very difficult to do.
Yes. It's not easy. Not everyone does it.
Yeah. It's very difficult. But somehow, especially when we have a loss or a major stressor, the world is not the same. And if we don't change those mental maps, then in some ways we don't adapt to the world, and we set ourselves up for mental health problems or physical health problems or a lot of problems. In fact, on the stress scale I mentioned, they say that if you have a score of 300 or above, you're at a very high risk for any number of mental health problems, and probably physical health problems too. Not only to answer Taylor's last question, but to stress the importance of somehow adapting to the world around us rather than trying to stay true to a mental map that is no longer an accurate reflection of the world.
Here are a few questions. Do you think because Alex was raised to not show emotions, that's why he can lie so easily? So I think another way to ask that too is, what makes it so someone can lie so easily?
Let's go back to the, since we're going back to the crab bucket analogy.
It's all about the crab bucket tonight.
I think that when the family or the crabs in the bucket are really dysfunctional, and especially the parents, when the parents are giving mixed messages, or the parents are so self-absorbed or narcissistic that they're not able to really read the child's needs, lying becomes a much more viable option for a child raised in that situation. So I think especially parents that are constantly in conflict, or parents that are fighting, those parents will present different views of the world to their children, and the children often get very confused about how to make sense of the world. One strategy to deal with that is to lie.
Kathleen asks, do you believe there was DV in the family marital relationship? Thinking about Paul's treatment of Morgan, and that has me wondering.
This question about domestic violence is interesting. I think if the reports of Alec supposedly abusing a sex worker are accurate, and this person seems to tell a fairly compelling story, then you'd have to wonder if there was violence in the marriage for sure. That for him to be physically abusive to someone he hired for sex, that's a really bad sign about what Alec is capable of. Was there violence in the marriage? It wouldn't be surprising. Obviously, I don't know for sure, but certainly one of the theories of domestic violence is that it's learned from the parent that's violent. And if Paul, we know Paul was violent, so it certainly seems probable.
Dr. Babe, any last thoughts?
Yes, actually. So, you know, I like to end with something a little literary, so tonight will be no exception. I just want to reiterate this point about how hard change is and how oftentimes change takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. Obviously, we talked about how difficult change is and has been for the Murdoch family. There's a quote here by Emily Dickinson, who I love, by the way, but a little segment from one of her poems that I think summarizes a lot of what we've been talking about. The quote is, "The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind." And so I think The truth is difficult to bear. It's difficult to hear. It's hard, I think, to really acknowledge sometimes painful things, but it's better than being blind. And I think that in the Murdoch family, there's a lot of blindness. You know, I hope they can overcome that at some point, but I'm not certain.
Thank you, babe. Dr. Babe. This is funny. I haven't even told John this, but I was texting him and I was thinking about other things today and I was texting him and I put in Dr. John into my phone and I didn't know why your number didn't show up because I've never had him as Dr. John in my phone. And I laugh because I'm like, yeah, usually... I always joke that, no, of course I don't call him Dr. John in private. And then I was thinking about something and I was like, Dr. John, where's my husband's phone number? And so
there's actually a little, maybe we should end on this. There's actually a little bit of a funny story about when we were on Dateline the first time, Keith Morrison. So Lauren kept calling me Dr. John. And we were sitting next to each other and she kept saying, you know, what do you think, Dr. John? Or how about that? And so Keith Morrison, in the middle of the interview, he stopped the interview and he said, do you always call him Dr. John?
Yeah, I even confused Keith Morrison. He's like, what the heck?
What are you doing?
He's like, is this a thing? Is this a thing?
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I was frustrated that I couldn't find you in my phone this morning. I wanted to text you an article and I'm like, where is he? And I'm like, wait, I'm typing out Dr. John. And I just laughed. I was like, I got to show him that.
But you explained to Keith that you thought we were on a live and we weren't. So
right. And that's where Dr. Babe came from too. I dubbed you Dr. John. And so I started calling you that, but then I would call you Babe. And then people were like, what in the world? You're calling this guy a doctor and then you're calling him Babe, help us out. And so now you're Dr. Babe. It's evolved.
And by the way, I told Keith Morrison that it's a stage name. I said, no.
Whatever. You were like, yes. I demand at our house that she always calls me doctor.
Yeah, I said, right. When we're eating dinner, I demand that you call me Dr. John
I cook him dinner each night. I'm like, that. Dr. John, how would you like your steak cooked?
Right.
Yes, sir, Dr. John. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, thank you everyone again for joining with us. Join Patreon, patreon.com/hiddentruecrime. Thank you again for telling your friends about us. We're so grateful for the growth. It's because of all of you. So thank you so much.
Thank you to everyone for joining us. We're really, really grateful and humbled by all the support. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.